This is America on the Road, winner of the International Automotive Media Conference Gold Medal Award for Radio, and now in our 23rd year on the air. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com and the Coalition for Vehicle Choice. We'll be bringing you the latest automotive information from around the world over the course of the next several minutes. I'm Jack Nierad, and with me is Chris Teague. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Jack. I'm happy to be here.
And here is in Maine today, right? You're a Maine guy. How are things in Maine today?
I am. It's a beautiful day. We're enjoying a last gasp of summer, though we had the heat on this morning. It's a short sweater this afternoon and will be for the rest of the weekend, so I'm happy with that.
Right. So America on the Road has become bi-coastal now with you in Maine. I'm in Southern California, and I think that's a nice mix. So we both travel the circuit test driving cars. We certainly test drive a new vehicle pretty much every week and have been doing that. Well, I guess for quite a bit longer than you, but I'm quite a bit older than you, Chris. Tell us a bit about your family and your background.
Sure. Well, I got my start covering technology and worked my way through the ranks there before really deciding to make the jump into automotive. And I've been doing that for a couple of years now. Driving, as you said, a new vehicle every week. Every one I get, no matter how big or small, I jam both of my kids in the back seat. I have a 2-year-old, almost 3-year-old, and an almost 7-year-old. So we have some challenges with space, but it's a lot of fun, and they get to help me review the cars here in Maine, like you said. So we get some great weather to test all the vehicles in. All-wheel drive and some great snowy conditions here are always fun year-round.
And I think one of the great things about the way you test vehicles and what we try to do here on America on the Road is test cars for real people, the way real people would drive cars. I mean, we're certainly enthusiasts about cars, and we both love the car business and love individual cars. But at the same time, we understand that a lot of people use cars more as a tool than an object of enthusiasm, and we want to review vehicles for those folks, too. So let's talk about what's going on in the auto industry right now that is of interest. It seems like there's a lot of things going on. And, you know, what would be your top story? What do you think's the top one, Chris?
I think one of the most fun stories the past couple of weeks that has come out is the Porsche Taycan and the Tesla Model S sort of duel that's kind of popped up. It's definitely been entertaining to watch. Both from an enthusiast standpoint, because we now have a very high performance, very expensive all electric vehicle, but also from the business side of things with Tesla kind of jumping into a racing mix and really getting into a competition there when their focus, at least up until now on paper, has been, you know, let's be all environment all the time or all very friendly kind of future forward looking environmentally conscious brand. So it's a really interesting thing. You know, Elon Musk has his own Twitter personality, and Porsche is what they are, a very kind of stoic brand, but it's extremely entertaining to watch.
Absolutely, it is. I mean, in a lot of ways, Tesla has always been a bit schizophrenic because they have this certainly environmental and green persona, all electric, of course, and no fossil fuels, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, always have pushed high performance, like hyper performance, actually. It was something where you wouldn't think the twain would meet, but it seemed to be a magic formula. But now Porsche seems to want to dip into that.
I agree. And I think I forget where I heard it yesterday. One of the podcasts I listened to, there was an interesting take on the sort of flip in personality for Tesla, because just a couple of weeks ago, it was talk about our autopilot features, talk about our range and our charging times. And then literally 2 to 3 days later, it's, you know, to the Nürburgring. Let's go see how fast we could set a lap time. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out for their buyers and how many of them actually jump ship to go to Porsche when that vehicle comes out.
Right. Well, and I wonder if the general public or the Tesla buyer even, which Tesla buyer is certainly not the general public necessarily, has any kind of sense of what the Nürburgring is, why it's important, if indeed it is, and that alone is debatable. Talk a bit about the Nürburgring itself and what it has come to represent, a lap time at Nürburgring?
Well, for those of us that didn't grow up in the video game generation, I grew up playing Gran Turismo and a lot of other video games that prominently featured that track as one of the most difficult and longest tracks in motorsport. I don't know the exact length, but I do know that many brands, actually all brands who make a race car, anything close to it, go there to show off their lap times and how quickly they can go around. A lot of companies test their vehicles there, and people who are just enthusiasts from around the world go there to drive and test their skills. It's in Germany. Is it seven miles?
I think it's longer. It's actually something more like 23, or it used to be. I think maybe they've shortened it a bit, but it was at one point real roads, just regular roads that you drive on that they would cordon off for a big race or two every year. And now it has become more of a circuit that is largely used for testing, vehicle testing, and kind of become ipso facto a standard. But it's a situation where I wonder if the car companies are talking to one another and maybe to a handful of enthusiasts, and nobody else really cares much.
I think so. And there's a popular and growing opinion that developing a car on the Nürburgring makes it difficult to drive in everyday situations. So the more you tune it to go quick on a circuit, the harder it is to actually make it comfortable and usable on the road. So, that's a question of how many people are actually going to know or care what the Nürburgring actually is, but then how many people are going to enjoy the final product when it comes out or even care about it. So again, I think it'll be really interesting to see. The car that Tesla drove or tried to set the lap time with is not a production car. It's not a version that anybody can buy right now. So again, whether they actually end up making it for general consumption or not is yet to be seen. But it's a funny thing to test an electric vehicle for mass consumption on a racetrack simply to set a lap time.
Yeah, it is silly. Well, another news item that caught my interest this week was what they're doing in Monza for an auto show. I mean, we have seen auto shows across the country, and auto shows are evolving, whether the consumer out there is paying much attention to that or not. We're going to see vast changes in auto shows. In fact, I'm headed down to the Texas Auto Show in another week or so. That is going to remain a pretty traditional auto show, but in Monza in Italy, they're changing the auto show type completely. It's going to be outside at a racetrack. It will be very inexpensive for the manufacturers to participate in, and because of that, the organizers think they're going to get a great turnout of car manufacturers, and that's what drives attendance. So it'll be interesting to see whether an outdoor situation like that is meant to kind of be a festival in a lot of ways will be the key to making an auto show more relevant again.
I agree. It kind of changes the whole dynamic, right? The interior, the big displays, the expensive lighting and everything. It takes all that away, or at least changes it quite a bit. So it will be really interesting to see what that does, not just to the attendance, but to, how the cars make a showing.
Right. And of course, we're going to see that in the Detroit Auto Show. That's coming up in June. Typically, we would expect the Detroit Auto Show, which is arguably the best auto show in the United States, to happen in January. They have moved that after a lot of defections. The import manufacturers in particular decided that Detroit probably wasn't the best place to spend massive amounts of money to interest consumers, since they weren't selling very many cars in the Detroit area. So Detroit has moved its auto show to June and is going to have a format that in some ways is similar to what they're going to do in Monza, which will also be in June.
I think so. And then, Detroit in June is a much nicer place to be than Detroit in January in general. So that can't hurt their cause either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, when we come back, we're going to be doing some road testing, talking about two vehicles that we have driven over the course of the last week or so. And we'll report to you on that. So after these messages, come back to us, and we'll be right back right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. This is Jack Nerad back with you, and with me is Chris Teague. Thanks so much for being with us, Chris, our mainstay from Maine. And we're going to be talking about vehicles that we have driven and tested over the course of the last week or so. Again, with the idea of helping just regular people buy regular cars as opposed to crazy enthusiast cars, although we do like our crazy enthusiast cars too. Kind of a comparison in a way. I'm going to be talking about the all-new 2020 Ford Explorer. Chris, what's the vehicle you're going to talk about?
I'm going to talk about two, actually, and both are very similar to each other, but different in some ways. The 2020 Kia Telluride and the 2020 Hyundai Palisade.
And the nice thing is all three of those vehicles, all three in this segment, are largely competitive with one another. At least the Koreans would love to feel that both the Hyundai and the Kia were competitive with the Ford Explorer, which is kind of the big dog in that particular segment. So I'll launch into Ford Explorer a little bit. Ford Explorer is really all new for 2020. Ford has decided to change the architecture of the car back to a rear drive platform, basically a rear drive platform. Of course, a lot of these vehicles are all wheel drive, but it starts out with what is essentially kind of a truck-like rear drive platform. They had gone to a more crossover front drive look previously in the previous edition. And I think they believe, well, I don't just think because I've talked to them about it. I've talked to the Ford executives about it. And they believe they get much more functionality out of a rear drive platform, better towing, better packaging of people inside, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a vast change. Ford Explorer, of course, is known for its styling. That's one of the key attributes that seem to turn people on. It's a little more exciting in its styling than a lot of mid-sized sport utility vehicles. That has not changed. Certainly, the styling itself has changed, but the desire to have great styling has not changed, and I think this is a very good-looking vehicle. Because of the amount, or largely because of the number of Explorers they sell, they're able to do many, many variations. There's a hybrid variation. There's a four-cylinder turbocharged powered variation, 3-liter turbocharged V6 powered variation, and then there's a sport version, the Explorer ST, that I just fell in love with right off the top. It is a 6 or 7 passenger SUV as normally configured. They have made the switch, and I want your take on this, Chris. They have gone to captain's chairs in the second row versus a bench. How do you feel about that?
It's an interesting thing, and I actually like the captain's chairs, but anybody with more than 2 kids is going to have someone in the third row without a friend. And the captain's chairs are interesting because they kind of keep the second row children apart from each other. They can't touch or poke each other, which is a cautionary.
Yeah, at least it's harder.
Yeah, it's a little bit harder, but then you end up with a situation where you can't sit 3 across in the second row. So we've had times when we have a third kid that we're either taking a friend somewhere or picking up someone and they end up in the back seat, which some kids really like to have their own space, but it's just something to keep track of. But it does help keep things separated.
Right. Well, I think it's a mixed blessing. I'm the Nerads are a family of 5. We have 3 daughters. They're almost grown now, but I had plenty of instances where, what do you do with that third kid if you just got 2 seats in the second row? And like you say, that third kid is kind of relegated to Siberia back there. and some might like it. Some pretty much don't. You can get a bench seat as a second row in a Ford Explorer, though. So that is good. And overall, I like the vehicle a bunch. I really like the fact that they have switched to the rear drive platform that has a lot of benefits in terms of ride and handling. I think there's a nice compromise in the ride and handling of the Ford Explorer. It's in ST form with 400 horsepower. It's kind of a tall race car in a way, or close to it. But for most folks, they're going to like the hybrid or the 4-cylinder or the V6. Plenty of towing capability. Just a good all-around vehicle. I think they've done a nice job with it, and so I give the Ford Explorer for 2020 very high marks.
I'd agree with that. I think the new styling cues are great. I think that they've definitely. I've always thought the Explorer is one of the best-looking vehicles in the segment, but the new look, especially the ST with the blacked-out trim, is really great, and that 400 horsepower V6 has got to be really nice. They did a good job with the Edge ST, that engine, the 335 horsepower, I think was very lively. So I can't wait to drive one of those, the Explorers.
Yeah, you'll have a good time with it. And so you have Korean twins, really, that you're talking about. You're talking about the Hyundai Palisade and the Kia Telluride, both introduced a little earlier this year, and both designed to maybe steal a little bit of the Ford Explorer's thunder. Tell us a bit about them.
I think they will do some thunder stealing if they haven't done so already. I drove the Kia Telluride about 2-3 weeks ago, and I have the Palisade in my driveway right now. They're both very similar to each other, both V6, both front-wheel drive standard, all-wheel drive optional, and both completely on the value front, top out, fully loaded at around $48,000. So there's a lot to like price-wise and a lot to like from a feature set. The Kia that I drove, that's a little bit more rugged, is the name you probably could guess. Telluride versus Palisade. It's just kind of a naming convention. But the Kia is a little bit more muscular, a little bit more squared off. I actually prefer the look of the Telluride to the Palisade. But both are very, if you want to call them, handsome, good looking. And the Palisade itself is a little bit cushier. So fully loaded. There's all sorts of great tech features for the kids. We really enjoyed. We have Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, those second row bucket seats in both the Telluride and the Palisade. Quilted leather in the Palisade and the Telluride's leather is very nicely stitched. So I think for both brands, it's really a move up market, which they've both been doing for quite a while now. But it really takes that notion of the budget kind of cheapo brand that they had, you know, even just 10 years ago, and turns it on its head. So some people might balk at spending almost $50,000 for a Kia or for a Hyundai, but I think that for many, many perspectives, there's really no good reason not to consider both of them, especially when you look at the warranty and what you get for the money.
Absolutely. And you know, at almost $50,000 or high 40s, you're talking about a fully loaded vehicle. You can't get one that costs any more than that. And there are plenty of variations that are, you know, probably less than $40,000 that would be more than acceptable for families out there. I think both of those vehicles are really good alternatives for folks who are looking in the midsize SUV category. They're just really nice vehicles with good looks inside and out and nice drivability.
I absolutely agree. I drove from Boston to Maine last night. It was about a 3.5-hour drive in the Palisade, and I fell in love. It's one of the most comfortable highway cruising vehicles I've ever been in of any type. Quiet, very smooth. I'd say it's almost luxurious. You know, driving the Lexus RX, you could almost compare there. I mean, even though there's, you know, Lexus build quality and what it is, but Hyundai and Kia, they've both knocked it right out of the park with these two, and I would quickly recommend them to anyone shopping for three rows.
Right. So really what we've got here is a trio of vehicles, all new, pardon the redundancy there, but all new for 2020 in the midsize SUV category, one of the hottest categories in the market for sure, that are all more than acceptable. I think all great players. So, you know, nothing to complain about with any of them, really.
I agree. The segment has been hot for a long time, but with Ford stopping most of their cars and a lot of other companies going all in, I think we're going to see it get even more exciting in the next couple of years.
Yep, absolutely true. When we come back, I'll be interviewing Daniel Koch. He is a senior technical leader for hybrid architecture at Ford Motor Company. We'll talk to him about the Ford Escape Hybrid and what's going on hybridization-wise across Ford Motor Company's lineup of vehicles. So stay with us for that. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. This is Jack Nierad back with you, and thanks so much for being with us. We really do appreciate it. Chris Teague and I really enjoy doing America on the Road, so thanks for being with us. I'm getting the opportunity right now to speak with Daniel Koch. He is the senior technical leader on hybrid architecture for Ford Motor Company and on the specifically on the SUVs that Ford is doing hybrid-wise these days. We're talking to him on the occasion of driving the all-new Ford Escape for 2020. So let's go to that interview with Daniel Koch right now. A lot going on with this vehicle, but I think you have a particular philosophy about hybridization for Ford vehicles these days. Tell us a bit about that, and then we can dive into the vehicle itself.
Yeah, so we believe that the power split architecture, which is the architecture that we're using in today's Fusion Hybrid, for instance, that really is an architecture that still has a lot of opportunity to support our front-wheel drive architectures going forward. That means that we're really working hard to perfect it, not just from a fuel economy perspective, but also for other attributes, vehicle attributes like towing and range. But there is a limitation to that. So what we have introduced recently is the Ford Explorer Hybrid that you may be familiar with. And that Explorer Hybrid uses a different architecture. So it uses what we call a modular hybrid technology architecture. And that is more geared towards delivering high torque for instance, truck applications, sports utility vehicle applications, mm-hmm. where there's more need for performance or more need for towing or more need
and,
for off-road.
And really kind of seamlessly no compromise, right? I mean, where you wouldn't know whether you're in a hybrid or not in a lot of ways.
Correct. And that's we think that we've really achieved that here in the 2020 Escape Hybrid, where a lot of the features and a lot of the utility and the versatility that we have in our vehicles with a conventional internal combustion engine powertrain, that we carry that over towards the hybrid vehicle. So let me give you an example of that. We have five modes in these vehicles, five selectable driving modes. There's a normal driving mode, there's a sport driving mode, there's an eco driving mode. We have a driving mode for deep sand and snow, and there's a slippery driving mode. And all those driving modes are available on both the conventional application and on the hybrid vehicle.
And this would have been unheard of 2, 3, 4 years ago, correct? Almost impossible to do.
I think so. And what we have seen is that our customers, as we see the technology to be more democratized, so more people beginning to use the hybrid technology, there is a less willingness to compromise mm-hmm. on some of those attributes.
And that also broadens the base of buyers, right? I mean, there are those adopters who want hybrid and are willing to put up with maybe some issues with it. But to get general acceptance, people don't want any issues. They don't want to have to put up with things that they're not used to.
And rightfully so, I think. So the technology really has moved forward. When we started the original Escape Hybrid back in 2005, let me give you an example. We had to install a battery pack that basically covered the whole trunk area, the cargo area flat in the floor. What we've been able to
and
do
is
today...
And 4 inches, 5 inches thick, right? I mean,
right.
So...
Right, yeah. Yeah, so it was still usable, but there was that battery pack there.
Right.
Now today, where we are with our fourth generation of hybrid, we've made our batteries liquid cooled. And that means we've been able to make them much more compact, much more flat, and seal them. So that means that the battery is not just 30% lighter and 30% smaller. We can now also place it under the floor of the vehicle. So under the body of the vehicle. So you as a driver or as a customer do not see that battery at all.
It's really amazingly small. When one looks at it, one goes, how can this be? How can this be the battery pack given what we've seen before? It's about the size of a briefcase, say.
Correct. And all of that is driven by the approach of using lithium-ion cells, lithium-ion, the latest lithium-ion technology, and use that in a liquid-cooled battery pack. And that's fairly unique in the hybrid world.
Yeah, and by doing liquid cooling, you control many things that you couldn't otherwise, or you need to do to use that lithium ion versus the other battery chemistries that you've used before.
Correct. When you compare liquid cooling to to air cooling, we can work the battery harder. So because we can cool the battery in a better way, it means that we can do more with the battery. To give you an example, in the 20 model year Escape Hybrid, we can drive in electric only mode all the way up to 85 miles per hour.
Which is unheard of. I mean, it's quite an amazing feat, really, to do that. do that. We talked a little bit about the research before we went on the air. We talked a little bit about the research you've done at Ford Motor Company on previous hybrid owners, you know, use case, real world use. Tell us a bit about that. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, so one of the things that we have done is we've looked at how customers are actually using our vehicles based on data that we were able to capture with the permission of our customers around how they're being used. So what that means is that we can look at what is the daily distance that our customers are actually driving the vehicles. And then you see an interesting trend happening, that there is a habitual daily distance. And that is, for instance, five times in the week, Monday to Friday, I'm driving to work and back. But then in the weekends, maybe I do shorter trips to the bakery, or maybe I make a longer drive from Detroit to Chicago, for instance. But the habitual trips are actually the length of those trips come out on average for the wider population to be somewhere in the order of about 30 miles. And we are using that to drive the sizing of our battery pack for the plug-in hybrid vehicle, where we're targeting 30 miles of all-electric range.
Right. And, you know, given that, let's say your commute is 25 miles, you give yourself a little extra space there in range. You might not buy gasoline for 2 or 3 weeks or something, or much longer.
Or maybe much longer.
Know, unless you... You know, take a long trip. You know, do that trip to Chicago from Dearborn or wherever you're going from.
And what we actually see there is that our customers tend to plug in at home. So at least once per day, they come home, plug it in, and drive off fully electrically again in the next day. Now, some employers offer charging opportunities at work. You're probably familiar with parking structures that have more and more these plug-in opportunities. Yeah. Sometimes our customers can plug in more than once per day, but on average we see them
And it's kind of a bonus, I think, that you're able to do that versus something you'd necessarily count on. You know, if you're at the shopping center and you're going to be there for 2 or 3 hours, maybe you can plug in and that would make some sense. You know, maybe it doesn't even make sense then, you know, for that short a period of time. We talked a little bit, again, before we went on the air, about the compromises involved in range versus cost. Take us through that, because, you know, that's a balancing act.
Yeah, so if we go back to that habitual daily distance of about 30 miles. Now, some customers will say, no, but my trip to work is longer. The question that we as an OEM need to ask ourselves is, for the wider population of our customers, what is the right size of the battery?
Right.
Because if I install too large of a battery in it, then a large part of our customers may be having to purchase a vehicle.
Yeah, affordability goes down, basically. It becomes harder for people to buy. Yeah.
Affordability and also the weight of the vehicle. So this is really about how do you make the right choice for the wider population to on the one hand maximize the utility for as many people as possible, but at the same point in time don't install too large of a battery pack for the other part of the population.
What do you think the overall prospects are, you know, 5-10 years out for plug-in hybrids? Will they be an important part of the market, still a niche part of the market? You know, there are a lot of conflicting feelings about what's going on, particularly, I think, with plug-in hybrids.
Yeah. The way how I see it is, I think it's good to realize that, like with any new technology, it starts with an innovator, a group of customers, and then you have the early adopters. So I really think that plug-in hybrids are in that field of early adopters. There are some things that you need to change in how you operate with the vehicle, like you charge, like you have to charge your phone today on a daily basis. You need to change how you interact with the vehicle. That will take some time. One of the things that we have seen is that people who are accustomed to a hybrid vehicle ultimately are looking for, hey, I would like to see my engine to be off more often,
yes.
And that means that there's a natural progression there for those customers to migrate into a plug-in hybrid vehicle.
Yeah. There has to be more infrastructure, really, to support plug-in hybrids, almost, if not quite to the extent of pure EVs, almost to that extent. You talk about how typical plug-in hybrid owner plugs in virtually every night. Yeah. But if I'm an apartment dweller, I might not have that ability, or I would have to find a place, you know, to do that that is not typical, you know. And at the same time, the Escape is being pitched to us as an urban vehicle. So yeah. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, no, that is true. And that's a bit of the tension field, I think, that is out there. What we see in certain parts of the country, California, for instance, building codes are being updated to encourage, if not mandate, the opportunity for customers, for people to charge, even in different condominium areas, for instance.
Right.
So there is there is definitely that part. At the same point in time, I think it's good to realize that, again, this technology is still on a fairly low volume in terms of the overall the migration of the technology into the main space. So I think what we will see is there is time for the infrastructure to catch up with what our customers ultimately want, which is, as I said, charging at home primarily, and then have opportunity charging during the day in different places.
Got it. Let's swing back a little bit to the 2020 Escape and the 2020 Escape Hybrids specifically. What do you think is your biggest achievement? What are you proudest of having accomplished with this round of hybrid?
Yeah, I think what I mentioned earlier, we've really focused hard on trying to reduce any compromises that we have with these hybrids. And that means that we've chosen the right system sizing, the right engine with the right efficiency. We've chosen the right sizing of the electric machinery in the transmission. We've chosen the right battery size and the battery technology. And that, coupled with the, what I mentioned earlier, the liquid cooling of the battery pack and taking it completely out of the occupant space or the cargo space, I think that is our biggest achievement here. And I really hope that our customers will be encouraged by no longer having these compromises. So yeah. It's an and solution. You have fuel economy, great fuel economy, and you have great range, and you have performance. And there's also a towing capability now, to give you an example. The Escape Hybrid now is able to tow up to 1,500 pounds.
And that was impossible before with air cooling of the battery and the battery pack.
It's actually a complete system design, but the battery, it plays a big role in that part, yeah.
Terrific. Well, Daniel Koch, thanks so much for being with us. We do appreciate it.
Very welcome. Thank you, Jack, for having me.
And that was Daniel Koch again, Senior Technical Leader for Hybrid Architecture at Ford Motor Company. We thank him for being with us. And that's it for this edition of America on the Road with Chris Teague. This is Jack Nerad. Thanks so much for being with us, Chris. Always enjoy talking to you about cars and about other things, too. I look forward to doing this more and more.
You as well, Jack. Thank you for having me on. I look forward to more chats.
Well, we'll do that as early as next week. And I look forward to that. And we hope you join us again right here on America on the Road on Driving Today. I'm Jack Nerad.